From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! What did Mobil know when the Indonesian army turned Aceh into a killing field? Did the oil giant provide crucial logistical support used to dig mass graves? Also, we'll talk to peace activist Phil Berrigan, just out of jail for hammering on an Aegis destroyer, about the president's plan to give $100 billion more dollars to the Pentagon. And what does Y2K mean for the progressive community? All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Senate plans to open President Clinton's impeachment trial tomorrow, but most everything else about the trial is still on the table. Majority Leader Trent Lott and Democratic Leader Tom Daschle both say they want a trial that is quick and fair, but Daschle says he would rather not have witnesses, something House prosecutors want. Meanwhile, the Senate senior Democrat has issued the first indication that any of the Senate's 45 Democrats could vote to remove Clinton from office. West Virginia's Robert Byrd says he could go either way based on the evidence he's seen and heard. The impeachment of President Clinton casts a shadow as Congress opens a new session today. The House will start its business by electing a new speaker, Republican Dennis Hastert, who will replace Newt Gingrich. Hastert will then deliver the oath of office to his Hass colleagues. While the corporate media has described him as avuncular and grandfatherly, health activists are concerned that he has been a point man for insurance companies on health care. There are 40 new members in the House. 23 are Democrats, 17 Republicans, shrinking the GOP majority. The balance in the Senate remains the same, with 8 new senators, 4 Republicans and 4 Democrats. A Senate impeachment trial could slow the prospects for legislation, but if anything gets done, many lawmakers say they hope it will be a law to strengthen Social Security. And explosive information in both the Washington Post and Boston Globe today. This in the Washington Post, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan has obtained what he regards as convincing evidence that United Nations arms inspectors helped collect eavesdropping intelligence used in American efforts to undermine the Iraqi regime, according to confidants who said he's deeply alarmed by the implications of the relationship for the world body. The accounts made available to Annan, some of which draw on classified U.S. information passed to him through intermediaries, describe an operation in which the UN Special Commission, or UNSCOM, took steps to assist the United States in listening to some of the most sensitive communications of the Baghdad regime, while acknowledging that the eavesdropping aimed in part to help the inspectors hunt down forbidden weapons or the means to conceal them. The Secretary General's confidant said Annan is convinced that Washington used the operation to penetrate the security apparatus protecting Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. and the Boston Globe reports that U.S. intelligence worked under the cover of the U.N.'s inspection program to listen in on secret Iraqi communications tracking the movements of leader Saddam Hussein. Sources also say that U.S. infiltration of Iraqi security is more extensive than publicly reported, with UNSCOM sometimes unwittingly helping out U.S. efforts. Black farmers are glad to see their racial discrimination lawsuit against the government end, but they say the damage has been done. As many as 3,000 black farmers will share a $375 million settlement with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, which includes $50,000 payments and wiping clean the farmers' government debts. Farmers say they were unfairly denied government loans and subsidies. Don't forget, the cold weather affects everyone, but it may have its biggest impact on the homeless, who must find a way to stay warm if they get caught outside. And authorities say they found no link between a Wyoming woman's death and her son's pending trial for the murder of Matthew Shepard. Cindy Dixon found dead Sunday, apparently from hypothermia, but police are investigating Dixon's death as a homicide. Her son, Russell Henderson, is accused in Shepard's beating death last October.
I am a medicine man. I do a medicine dance. I am a medicine man, I sing a medicine chant. I am a medicine man, I have a medicine tail. I am a medicine man, I walk a medicine trail. I am a medicine man, I do a medicine dance. I am a medicine man, I sing a medicine chant.
Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Known for punishing his friends and rewarding his enemies, President Clinton has proposed the largest peacetime military spending increase since the Reagan era for the fiscal year 2000 budget. A $110 billion hike will be earmarked for attack helicopters, sophisticated new jets, and warships if Congress approves. Like when Clinton bombed Iraq on the eve of the president's impeachment and bombed the Sudan the day of Monica Lewinsky's grand jury testimony, the more than $100 billion military increase request comes at a time when Clinton appears politically vulnerable. The Balanced Budget Act of 1997 requires any increase in spending be offset by cuts in another part of the budget. This is going on at the same time as President Clinton is pushing for the privatization of Social Security, saying we cannot afford it. And one of his appointees on a federal panel looking at the future of Medicare is saying new taxes would be required to keep the program that cares for the elderly intact. We're joined right now by two people to talk about the proposed military budget increase. Michael Clare is with us, professor of peace and world security studies at Hampshire College in Massachusetts. And Phil Berrigan joins us from Maryland, Plowshares activist just out of jail after finishing a 2-year sentence for hammering on an Aegis destroyer. We welcome you both to Democracy Now! Michael Clare, what were your first thoughts when you heard President Clinton announce the $100 billion rate hike for the military budget?
You know, it's easy to associate this with the current impeachment trial in the Senate and say, yes, he's doing this to, you know, keep the military friendly at this time of crisis. And I'm sure that was in his mind. But I just sighed and thought, this is more of the same. This is more of the consistent U.S. policy since the end of the Cold War to maintain the U.S. status as the world's sole superpower and to perpetuate American power indefinitely into the future on a global scale. I think that's what this is about. It could have been predicted. The timing may be connected to the Senate proceedings, but the basis of the strategy is not new. It's more of the same, and it's very troubling.
Explain a little more what you think President's strategy is. While some say he brings these proposals forward, throwing red meat to conservatives when he wants to get something from them, perhaps, you know, not being thrown out of office, others say that he has carried this out, as you say, his policy around the military for all the years he's been in office.
I think that when the Cold War ended in 1989, when the Berlin Wall fell, American leaders faced a crisis. They could choose either to face the new world in a new way and move in the direction of multilateral government, the UN, and that sort of direction, or they could choose a different path. And the path they chose was to maintain the United States as the world's dominant military power and to use American military power to maintain the world in a friendly way, let's put it that way, a way friendly to American interests. And it doesn't matter whether it's Republicans or Democrats in office, they all share this view that America has to remain the sole superpower, to use its military force to punish what are described as rogue states or outlaws. And then you could read into that Muslims, Islamic states, third world states, whatever, but the other, the alien, to maintain the dominance of the Western U.S.-dominated world. And I think that's just a consistent U.S. policy.
Phil Berrigan, what were your thoughts? You were just let out of prison in November, serving 2 years for one of your plowshares actions, in this case, hammering on an Aegis destroyer, which was NBC-capable, nuclear, biological, chemical-capable, just what the U.S. Accuses Saddam Hussein of being. What are your thoughts on this military budget proposal?
Well, I keep reminding myself that, and others that war's our number one business, and I would agree with Michael that it's just more of the same. We're an imperial power, and we're about protecting our interests overseas and extending our hegemony, maybe China is next, or other elements of the world that aren't directly under our tariff and trade agreements. But all of this has to be protected by the nuclear strike force and by the conventional killing machine that we have. So I wasn't quite surprised about it. I remember in past years, sometimes the most suffocating arms budgets were passed through the Congress with only minutes of debate. And I've known Congress people, too, who would not give a nickel to the Pentagon and who consistently voted against it. There was one black congressman, Perrin Mitchell from Baltimore, who did that. But I'm also reminded, and I tell people constantly as well as I can, that the only resource left for us under this suffocating, arms huckstering and arms racing, this time with ourselves, is the American people. And either they wake up and come out of the woodwork and take to the streets through direct action and nonviolent civil disobedience, or we're going down the tube. And that's the element that seems to be, seems to need emphasis. You know, the analysis is all there, you know, it's part of a pattern, but the response, we're very unclear about that, and we're very negligent to pick up responsibility for what this country has become.
Phil Berrigan, I have to ask what this world, particularly U.S. politics, looks like to you after being in prison for 2 years. You come out of prison. I think many in this society see plowshares activists like you as, well, really looking a little crazy, that you go out there, you hammer on a B-52 bomber or an Aegis destroyer or an F-15E fighter plane, and you pour your blood on it, you make a little dent, and then you go to prison for years. You're seen as crazy. The rest of society feels a lot more normal. So you now come out of prison, and you look at the state of politics today in America.
Well, Amy, sometimes I want to, you know, break down and weep or crawl behind a piece of woodwork. You know, it's so horrifying. Recently, our friends from Voices in the Wilderness are soaked by the Treasury Department with $163,000 because they brought medicine and toys to dying Iraqi children. You know, now how the hell do you get much lower than that? So you want to weep, but you know, your friends remind you that you got to keep going. Our message is a very, very simple one. You know, there's no alternative to disarmament. We've coexisted with these weapons now for 53, 54 years, and, you know, our skein, as they say, is running out. That's a very simple message out of Plowshares. Either we disarm or maybe we choose some sort of mass catastrophe or even extinction.
Phil Berrigan, for people who aren't familiar with the whole Plowshares philosophy, can you explain what it is, why your movement is even called Plowshares?
Well, we try to deal with the Judeo-Christian tradition, and we single out the prophecy of Isaiah in the second chapter, where he speaks about a people acceptable to God. People who don't learn war anymore and go into disarmament, beat their swords into plowshares. And this is backed up by the Sermon on the Mount, Christ enjoins us to love your enemies. And that's the test of a truly religious life, that you love your enemies and that, in fact, you don't have any. And if occasion comes, like the government singles out the Iraqis and Hussein as our enemies, if occasion comes, you know, you try to protect your enemies from those who would destroy them, like our government. So that's a simple thing, and it's all encapsulated in this effort to disarm. And we hope that other folks, you know, pick up the message, because it's not a very, very elusive one, or it's not highly abstract. You know, we're going to have to disarm. That's all there is to it. Our best minds in the Western world and around the planet have told us that, and I don't see any option.
In this past week, five Plowshares activists, some of whom you live with, were sentenced by a Maryland judge for an action that they engaged in last May 17th, which was the 30th anniversary of the Catonsville Nine, of which you were one of the members in 1968, I guess.
Amy, yeah.
And at that time, tell us what you did in 1968.
Well, very, very briefly, we went to a draft board outside of Baltimore here that had not yet moved into the Customs House complex. And we considered this whole machinery of conscription to be inhuman and to be unconstitutional and what have you. So the focus was upon selective service. And we went to this draft board and we immobilized, because there were nine of us, we immobilized the clerks there just by interposing ourselves, keeping them away from phones and what have you, and we took out about 350 1A draft files and brought them to the parking lot outside and burned them with homemade napalm, and then stood around for arrest. And out of that, Tom Lewis and myself got six-year sentences, and we served a large portion of them.
And so on the 30th anniversary of that event, you had five Plowshares activists going to a massive nuclear military hardware show in Maryland that Democracy Now! Actually had a chance to go to and cover this action. And I think our listeners who are regular listeners remember what happened to us as the military confiscated our tapes, held us incommunicado for 6 hours. We eventually got out, and after a battle with our lawyers, we got the tapes back. The military doesn't like these kind of actions to be recorded, but those five activists were ultimately charged and convicted and were sentenced this week. Tell us what they face, Phil Berrigan.
The sentences are predictable, Amy. We know they're going to be done by rote. We know that all sorts of elements of international law and constitutional law are going to be suppressed. I've been on trials where you operate under an ad limine motion, which suppresses even reference to the Bible, or the nuclear arms race, or foreign policy of the United States, what have you. The courts, we found, are the measurements of the society. And the courts align themselves and identify themselves completely with the government and its military interests. And so when you bring up intense political questions like Plowshares people do, then anything that would warrant their actions or provide motivation would be suppressed. And we found that to be a pattern with over 60 Plowshares actions from 1980 on. We found that to be a pattern. So it's nothing surprising. In fact, some trials have gone so badly that we just terminate them and we turn our backs upon the court after reading a statement, and we exhort our friends in the courtroom to go into resistance right there, because everything in a society is centered in its courts. So we expected the sentences to be even more harsh than they were the other day.
Sentenced to the five Plowshares activists, priests, nuns, and a religious laywoman between 4 and 10 months.
Yes. And, you know, all of us can do the jail time. It's not a good place to be. In fact, no human being should have to undergo it. But we can do it. And, I think you've also heard about the fact that some of our people are in exile and can't even return home. And have been sentenced to a kind of domestic exile.
Phil Berrigan, I want to ask you about that, but we have to break for stations to ID themselves. Please stay with us. And I also want to thank you, Michael Clare, Professor of Peace and World Security Studies at Hampshire College in Massachusetts, for your response on this latest proposal by Clinton on the eve of a Senate trial deciding whether to kick him out, to propose a $100 billion increase for the U.S. military, greater than any president has proposed right through to Reagan. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! In a minute, we'll be back with Phil Berrigan for him to let us know what this domestic exile is all about. And then we're going to take a look internationally at an oil multinational corporation, Mobil, and what did it know about the mass killings going on in Aceh, Indonesia, and did it participate in covering them up. Stay with us. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, as we finish up our conversation with Phil Berrigan, Plowshares activist, just finished serving a 2-year sentence for being part of an action 2 years ago in Bath Iron Works in Maine, where he hammered on an Aegis destroyer and threw his own blood on that NBC-capable missile, NBC-capable meaning nuclear, biological, chemical. Phil Berrigan, you were just saying that some people are in exile today. What do you mean?
I mean by that, Amy, two members of our community can't return home. They can't live here.
Here meaning Jonah House in Baltimore, Maryland?
Yes. The woman, Michelle Nar-Obed, and her husband, when she got out of federal prison down in Tallahassee, Florida, after having served an 18-month sentence, she was forbidden by the probation department to return here. So, and she was not even allowed to join the Catholic worker community in Norfolk, Virginia. She was required to return to the area that had sentenced her, because she had been arrested at this huge shipbuilding company, Newport News, right adjacent to Norfolk.
So even though she has served her time, when she is out of jail, she's not allowed to live where she chooses?
No. And her husband and her little daughter was here with us, members of our community, and they had to move just to join her. It was a pretty inhuman process. So they moved down to Norfolk and had to rent a separate apartment and lived there for the better part of 6 or 9 months, and then they were allowed to move to a Catholic worker community in Duluth, Minnesota. No prospect of returning home yet.
Is the idea to break up your community at Jonah
Heights? Precisely. You got it. The idea is to break up anybody that, or any community that would get together at Plowshares Action. Yeah, and meanwhile, Susan Crane, who is serving a 27-month sentence in Dublin, a federal joint in Dublin, California, has been told point-blank that she can't return home either. And she's been declared homeless, which is to say, go to a halfway house in Portland, Maine, where you were sentenced, and then save your money and then get a place of your own. But you can't come back to Baltimore.
Is there any chance of Jonah House breaking up?
No, not in the slightest. No, in fact, Amy, we're going to have to confront this situation and iron it out some way.
Yet you were allowed to return home.
I was allowed to return home, I guess because they understood that I would come anyway.
Well, Phil Berrigan, I want to thank you very much for joining us and, I guess welcome home now that you're out of prison and at Jonah House in Baltimore.
And thank you for your work, Amy.
Thank you. Our listeners who are regular listeners may remember that on St. Patrick's Day, we had a chance to visit Phil Berrigan in prison in Virginia and play that hour interview with him. I'd gone down there with Democracy Now! Producer Jeremy Scahill. Phil Berrigan speaking to us from Jonah House in Baltimore. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move international to a quite unbelievable piece that appeared in the Business Week magazine. It was the special double issue that wrapped up 1998 and moves into 1999, December 28th to January 4th issue. And it's entitled, What Did Mobile Know? Mass Graves Suggest a Brutal War on Local Indonesian Guerrillas in the Oil Giant's Backyard. This is how it begins. There are days when Tengku Bintara wonders how he ever survived. For 6 months in 1990 and 1991, he languished in a military prison camp in Indonesia's Aceh province. One day, Bintara, then the headman of a nearby village, was put inside a room whose walls were splattered with human blood and hair. During an interrogation that left him blind in the right eye, Bintara claims an Indonesian army officer whipped his scalp with a frayed cable, burned his pubic hair with a match, held live electric wires to his genitals and temples. Another time, the officer threatened to execute Bintara if he did not disclose the name of a Muslim separatist guerrilla leader, despite Bintara's insistence he didn't know him. Bintara's gruesome experience unfolded only a few hundred yards from the chemical plants and white storage tanks of PT Arun, a liquefied natural gas producer in which Indonesia's state-owned oil monopoly, Pertamina, holds a controlling 55% stake, and Mobil Corporation owns 35%. At the time of Bintara's detention, the plant employed 1,800 workers and was frequented by several Mobil advisors. Human rights groups have documented Rangkong as a known torture site, but Mobil says it was not aware of any such activity. Bintara claims he saw fellow inmates in the Rangkong camp being tortured and then tossed like dogs onto trucks. Well, the story in Business Week goes on to say, today all that remains of Rangkong is a crumbling cluster of row houses. What happened at Rangkong and throughout Aceh 8 years ago is very much a live issue in Indonesia. Since the fall of strongman President Suharto in May, a stream of witnesses such as Bintara have come forward with tales of atrocities committed by Indonesia's military. The events occurred during a three-decade campaign to suppress a guerrilla movement that sought independence for Indonesia's westernmost province. The survivors' tales raise questions about what Mobil knew and when. On October 10th, a coalition of 17 Indonesian human rights organizations issued a statement asserting that Mobil and PT Arun are responsible for human rights abuses during the military operation in Aceh. The groups allege Mobil Oil Indonesia, Mobil's wholly owned subsidiary, provided crucial logistics support to the Army, including earth-moving equipment that was used to dig mass graves. One such grave, excavated in the village of Bukit Sentong, contained at least a dozen bodies. Another allegation is that security forces seized a local Mobil employee on company property without a warrant. The employee has not been seen since. Well, that's how the article in Business Week begins. It's called What Did Mobil Know? We invited Business Week reporters to join us. Unfortunately, they were unable to come. I have to say, I think it's because while Business Week must be applauded for this important investigation it has done, a five-week investigation, it seems to be privishing the piece. That's opposed to publishing. That's right. You publish a piece, but you don't let it be known that you've published the piece. Their PR people can't publicize the fact that this piece is in Business Week. We also invited Mobil to join us. It is based in Fairfax, Virginia, and Mobil has declined to join us after a week of conversations. But we are joined by two people. We're joined by an Achenese lawyer who is based here in New York, and we're also joined by a man from Aceh, which is in the westernmost part of Indonesia. By the way, Aceh is spelled A-C-E-H, if you see it in the news, especially in the last week. A lot of attention as the Indonesian military once again moves in to suppress the Muslim population there. We're joined by an Achenese worker who was a Mobil contractor for a number of years, from 1988 to 1993. We welcome you both to Democracy Now!, Jafar Sadiq Hamza, attorney from Aceh, and, well, we'll call him Abjo, to protect his family, the Mobil contractor. Welcome both to Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Jafar, let's begin with you. A very important story that we are looking at today, what has been happening in Aceh, and particularly what Mobil's role in this story is.
Aceh historically was very well known for its role during the era of our fight against the Dutch colonizer. And the Indonesian government gave the Aceh, based on their contributions to this Republic of Indonesia, the special territory of Indonesia.
What a special status.
Yeah, special status. What we call it in Indonesia, Daerah Istimewa. But this, we learn from time to time, just as a written statement, without giving a chance to us to exercise this, what we call it as the autonomy. So what the Indonesian government did to Aceh, they just exploit the natural resources, which is very rich in Aceh, took the whole thing to Jakarta, and then returned to us less than 0.8%. Look at the Indonesian national budget. 1997-98, Indonesia collect from Aceh 32 trillion rupiah, while in return, they gave to Aceh only 290 billion. So then some people declare what we call it as Gerakan Aceh Merdeka or the Free Aceh Movement, the first in 1976. And then the second in 1989. So this how the movement started. In response to this separatist movement, the Indonesian government didn't try to solve these problems through open dialogue. But they sent troops, they sent soldiers from 76, and then they stopped sometime in 1982. And then when the guerrilla back in 1989, they sent thousands of soldiers to Aceh, including special unit, which has been known as Kopassus. Yeah.
The Kopassus troops have become well known here in the last year because of Alan Aaron's expose in The Nation magazine showing that U.S. troops trained the special Red Beret Caucasus troops in sniper tactics in counterintelligence and going out and torturing civilians.
Yeah. And they authorized these military officers to do whatever they want to in Aceh without any limit, without any limitation. So the government always said that these guerrilla members only supported by dozens of the activists. But then they already killed, according to the report provided by Care Human Rights of Aceh, that's an NGO in Aceh. They already killed about 8,000 civilians. Yeah. But they still believe that there is still the movement. There is still the members of this Free Aceh movement. And they don't only kill the people, but they rape our women. They hang upside down the babies, 6-month-old baby, and abort the woman that has been the victim of rape, including the disabled woman, from woman who cannot see or blind woman, 47-year-old, to woman who has no feet, to woman who had no hand. So,
what the Indonesian military was doing in Aceh was very well known in the area, and that really goes to the heart of the Business Week piece on Mobil. What did Mobil know the Indonesian military was doing when Mobil, for example, was providing excavation equipment to the Indonesian military, which human rights groups and others in the area, Acehnese residents say, was being used to dig mass graves? You've given a good background to what has been happening in Aceh, Jafar Sadiq Hamza. And now I'd like to focus specifically on Mobil. In the Business Week piece, it says that their probe uncovered more than a dozen sources who either witnessed atrocities or came upon their aftermath. Two contractors say they told local Mobil managers that they'd found human body parts close to Mobil sites. And a former Mobil employee says rumors of massacres and of reports that Mobil equipment was being used to dig graves were frequently discussed at workplaces and in a company cafeteria. It does go on to say there's no clear evidence Mobil's top management had direct knowledge of such reports. But it talks about what contractors repeatedly found, like along the same road a few months later. It was just finishing telling a story. A Mobil contractor was part of a team testing soil samples outside Dusun Serme, a village of 600 people living in wood shacks with dirt floors. As an excavator shoveled a mound of earth into a dump truck to be transported to a nearby Mobil construction site, the truck driver noticed a shoe lying on the ground. He jumped out of the cab, picked up the shoe, and collapsed in shock. It was attached to a severed human leg. The inspector reported the incident to a Mobil heavy equipment supervisor at the construction site. He had no reaction, says the contractor. At that time, it was normal not to say anything, just keep quiet. Mobil says it has no records or no knowledge of such a report. But it has been raised to the highest levels of the U.S. government. In fact, the U.S. ambassador to Indonesia, Stapleton Roy, discussed the allegations on November 3rd in Jakarta with visiting Mobil chair Lucio Noto, who denied knowledge of any misuse of Mobil equipment or facilities. And a State Department official told Business Week that the U.S. government has expressed concern about the allegations and is calling for Indonesian authorities to conduct a full investigation. Let me turn to you, Abgel. Yeah. You were a Mobil contractor during this period of the greatest atrocities against the Acehnese by the Indonesian military.
Yeah, I would like to explain a little bit as my experience during I work in Mobil Wheel Company. I start to work at Mobil Wheel Company began at in 1988 until 1993. During I worked there, because I used to work for heavy equipment mechanic, so that's like my boss. That always he asked me to fix
to fix machines when they broke down.
A soldier, soldier car.
To fix soldiers' cars.
Soldier car or any equipment of soldier. Always he asked to fix from Mobil.
So you were a mobile contractor, but mobile was asking you to fix soldiers' cars.
Yes, yeah. There's not only on the daytime, but sometimes at nighttime they come to mobile inside the MEM shop. That I mean, MEM shop, that means mobile equipment maintenance. Then I think that all people in mobile equipment maintenance, they knew what happened on that time, because every day, like Aubrey car that he come to mobile, will he ask to
when
serve.
You say Aubrey car, Aubrey, just for our military. Listeners, Aubrey the Indonesian military.
Yeah, yeah. That he come, that he ask to service like or maintenance oil every oil, and to service like oil every any kind of maintenance. And they come to for our shop. He come to our shop then to fix his their car.
I'm looking at the Business Week piece, and it says rumors spread of massacres in Bukit Santang, a village about 15 miles away from a place they called Skull Hill, where many bodies were buried. In 1991, Mobil used heavy equipment to widen a road that passed through the village, according to a former employee of Mobil's planning department, who used the road to reach a Mobil-operated gas field farther south. Every time I drove out there, the subcontractor stopped my car, says the source. They said, no, don't go out there. Don't you know the military is killing people and burying them in mass graves with Mobil equipment? This became a topic of lunchtime conversation at Mobil's bachelor camp mess hall, but it never went into an official report, he says. Mobil says it does not know of its equipment being used in that area. We're going to have to break for stations to identify themselves, and then we're going to have to wrap up this discussion. But I want to ask if you think it was possible, Abjil, for Mobil not to know as they operated in this place of mass graves and massacres. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, The Exception to the Rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk about what did Mobil know in Indonesia, Mobil, particularly in the news recently because of the proposed merger between Mobil and Exxon, which would make it the largest oil corporation and most powerful corporation in the world. Our guests are two people who know Mobil well, one an Achenese lawyer from the westernmost province of Indonesia, who is based in New York, as well as a Mobil contractor from Aceh, who is also here. We are not calling him by his right name because he fears for his family, who's still in Aceh, but Jafar Siddiq Hamza is the attorney. Let me ask you, Abjil, if you believe that Mobil could possibly not have known about what was being done around its property and with its equipment in the early 90s when you were a Mobil contractor.
Yeah. I think like Mobil will impossible if he didn't know about what that happened in Aceh begin in 1989 until 1993, because that happened. That's all that persecution that almost in Mobil will area, because I think they knew, because almost every day in the morning we found some human body they throw by the soldier beside the road, mobile wheel road, I mean. Like something, there is some like Baharudin, this Mr. Baharudin, they took from his office in point A. After they took from his office in point A until right now, his disappear until right now, nobody found his body.
Let me explain that case you're referring to, because Business Week describes it fully. Yeah. On July 10, 1990, an Army officer walked into the office of Mobil's production department and walked out with T. Abdullah Baharuddin, a 9-year Mobil employee. A colleague later told his widow, Haznidar, then nursing their 1-month-old son, that the officer had first asked permission from Baharuddin's superiors but had no arrest warrant. So she complained to Baharuddin's boss and to a Mobil public relations manager. More than a year later, on August 21, 1991, Haznidar finally received a letter from Mobil. It said Baharuddin's employment had been terminated and that he was to receive $3,500 in severance pay in line with existing company policy. Detainees released from Hong Kong later told her they'd seen Baharuddin there, explains one man. Mobil did inquire through, this explains a Mobil spokesperson, Mobil did inquire through appropriate government channels of Baharuddin's status and learned that he'd been detained by the authorities for security reasons. And Mobil points out that no company can stop lawful arrests on its premises. You knew him. You knew Baharuddin?
Yeah, I know Baharuddin. And until now, some people still being work in Mobil wheel. Then persecution by military in Indonesia. So if he need for the strong proof, or that means strong evidence about that, there still have many people being work in Mobil until right now.
Many people still work in Mobil to this day.
Who they ever persecution by Indonesian military?
Who face persecution by the Indonesian military.
Yeah.
I want to give you the last word, Jafar, to just sum up what we know about Mobil in Indonesia, in Aceh today.
I think there's a very strong argument to prosecute Mobil or to bring legal suits against Mobil. The first, because Mobil tends to be provide help to the Indonesian military in carrying these atrocities. At least Mobil allowed the military to use their facilities. Not to talk about if the military forced them or not, but at least Mobil has the power to say no of their status as multinational company. The second, several cases taken place in their site, what we call it as A13. The third, one of the worst military torture camp, what we you said is Hong Kong, which we pronounce it as Ranchong. That belong to their partners PT Arun, and I believe that Mobil are involved in this preparation of this site too. The fourth, that the Mobil had not taken any action when the military came to their office and brought their employees, Baharuddin, Sulaiman in this magazine, and I believe that many others, instead of searching for them, asking the military to release them, then a year later, the military and the Mobil companies then fired those disappearance people.
So when the Mobil workers were disappeared by the Indonesian military, the response of Mobil, even when some of those workers were taken right out from the Mobil office with the Indonesian military asking the permission of the Mobil employers, what would happen was Mobil would simply end their employment, terminate their employment when they had been disappeared for a certain period of time.
Yeah.
Well, I want to thank you both very much for joining us. It's a story that needs to be investigated further. The end of the Business Week piece says that Mobil raises questions about whether Mobil knew of the killings and did nothing. It says, in terms of a company's legal responsibility, U.S. law is murky because there's no precedent. The Alien Tort Claims Act allows U.S. companies to be sued for wrongful actions committed overseas. In the last few years, human rights groups and foreign victims have filed suit in U.S. courts seeking damages for activities by Royal Dutch Shell in Nigeria, Unocal in Burma, Texaco in Ecuador. The cases remain in courts. Meanwhile, Mobil's operations are going strong strong in the Aceh area, and its business there remains a lifeline for the struggling Indonesian economy. And as the country painfully examines its past, all those in Aceh, villagers, soldiers, and corporations must come to grips with a terrible legacy. I want to thank you both for being with us. Thank you to Jafar Sadiq Hamza, an attorney from Aceh, and thank you to Abjil being with us, a mobile contractor there for 5 years. I'm sorry Mobile would not join us to deal with these charges, and I'm also sorry that Business Week reporters were not allowed to come on to the show to talk about their very important investigation. But people should know that it is in the latest edition of Business Week, and it is a report called What Did Mobile Know? And it's in the December 28th, January 4th edition. If there is a phone number that you have that people can call if they're interested in further information on Mobile's activities in Aceh, where can they call?
I think 718-204-1079. And I would like to tell you, too, that we here at Aceh Forum of New York are preparing for the legal suit with several lawyers in New York. Hopefully this we can bring this together.
Well, we will certainly let our listeners know when you file that suit. Again, the phone number to call, 718-204-1709.
1079.
The number again, 718-204-1079. Sorry, 718-204-1079. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And in these last minutes of the show, we wanted to take on the issue of Y2K. I know a lot of you have heard about this issue. It is everywhere, the problem of computers at the end of this millennium moving into a new one. And we wanted to look at particularly how it affects the progressive community in this country. We're joined right now by Paul Martin, who chairs the board of Earth Culture and is a special advisor on the Y2K problem for the D.C. Green Party. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Paul.
Thanks, Amy, for your great show on truth and democracy and for having such American heroes as Philip Berggren on your show.
Well, thank you for being with us, Paul. So Y2K and the progressive community, what makes it different from any ever coverage we've seen of the issue? And maybe for those who've been a little out of touch, explain what Y2K is.
Well, the year 2000 computer challenge comes back from the 1970s. 1970s. Programmers use only two digits as a date, such as 98 instead of 1998, to save valuable space in their computer programs. Unfortunately, now, when we go to 2000, computers might think it's 1900. And what that means is bad data. For example, someone's date or age could be 29 or negative 29, and that could cause a computer program to crash or to give wrong information or for a whole system to crash. There's also the challenge of what's called the 99 problem, and what that is programs were made for when 99 came around in their program to have end of file or to stop. And recently in Stockholm, their passport computers crashed when they entered people as coming in 99. The other challenge is embedded systems. There's between 20 and 60 billion embedded computer chip systems around the world, and some of these are also programmed, hardwired, which means you can't go in and reprogram them with something with the year 2000 computer program in it. You need to go in to test them. So that's briefly what it means for the year 2000 computer challenge.
Now, what is this problem? Why do you see that it poses a special, or what is the special problem for the progressive community? Why would it be different for anyone else?
Well, let's look at Janet Abrams is the executive director of President Clinton's Council on Year 2000 Conversion. And she recently said in a teleconference that we may have a situation of lots of small disruptions across the country, a small utility, a power plant out, a water purification plant out in another community. These are situations that in usual times you might be able to call on the state or the federal government to help solve, but we are stressing to our local officials that they're going to have to take care of these problems on their own. And then when you see that the National Association of Counties completed a survey, and they say only 50% of the counties in the U.S. have done any preparation around the year 2000 issue, you can understand why Janet continues to say it is rational, as people mentioned, for individuals to have a Y2K contingency plan. And that means to have a certain amount of cash with them to make sure they have a certain amount of food with them. And that's her quote. Now, this affects things like the environment, and this is not something that you're seeing in the news. For example, the chemical company Rahm and Haas, which is about a $4 billion chemical manufacturer, said that they're going to shut down its plants in December of 99 to avoid any year 2000 glitches. That's a good thing. We want large major corporations to shut down rather than having any kind of chemical leaks or anything like that. The challenge is there's thousands of small chemical companies that are way behind on this issue, and the EPA is not stepping up to the plate to take a leadership role. All they've done so far is actually the opposite. They've weakened environmental laws by saying that chemical manufacturers and other companies can test for Y2K, and if they end up polluting the environment during the test, that's okay.
And what can people in the environmental movement and the peace movement do?
I'm sorry, can you repeat the question?
What can people in the environmental movement and the peace movement do?
Most of the experts agree that what we're looking at is community preparedness and community awareness. And what that means is many people may have seen the recent Utney Reader. Utney Reader has something called the Y2K Citizens Action Guide. And what's happening around the country in cities like the island of Kauai, the city of Lubbock, Texas, the city of Norfolk, Nebraska, communities are getting together and they're meeting with their government officials, they're meeting with business leaders, they're meeting with environmental activists, and they're all getting together to work on the issue cooperatively. And this is a solution that we need to look for. We need communities out there working together on this issue. And if people are interested in the Utney Reader Guide, it's available on the web at www.utney.com/Y2K, or they can call 1-800-736-UTNEY.
That's 1-800-736-UTNEY. Finally, Paul, you've been to a lot of conferences on the issue of Y2K. What about the issue of disadvantaged communities and how they can deal with this issue?
That's an excellent question. And I have been to a ton of conferences on this. And most of the questions are asked is, what am I going to do with my stock portfolio? And I can guarantee you that after the year 2000, we will not ask ourselves why we missed investing our savings in some Y2K compliant stock. In the spirit of Oscar Schindler, we will reflect and wonder why we failed to help more people in more communities. And what that means is that our communities, median income for a family of four here in the U.S. is $24,000. Now, how can, when the Red Cross says that we want you to prepare for a week without food, without water, without electricity, and have cash on hand, how do these people have that? What are we going to do for the people who can't afford to do something like that?
Well, I want to thank you very much, Paul, for being with us, and we hope to have you back soon. Paul Martin, Chair of the Board of Earth Culture, Special Advisor on the Y2K problem for the D.C. Green Party. Thank you very much for being there. And that does it for today's show. If you'd like to order a cassette copy of the program, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Carrion and Norman Kelly. Our technical director, Errol Maitland. Joe Gill, engineered from Washington, D.C. Special thanks to Robert Knight. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!